A new state law about the Ten Commandments is causing problems for Arkansas's flagship university campus. The ongoing government shutdown impacts one nonprofit's work serving Arkansans living with disabilities, and a new exhibit showcases a pioneering documentary filmmaker from the natural state. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the natural state. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. The installation of Ten Commandments posters on the University of Arkansas's Fayetteville campus to comply with a new state law has prompted public pushback and the loss of some funding. The Arkansas Advocate's Antoinette Grajeda has the details.
University of Arkansas alum Andy Kinslow says he established two scholarships at the Faye Jones School of Architecture and Design to help Arkansans who come from small towns like he did to realize their dreams.
I grew up in a town of 12,000 people, and I decided to be an architect in the third grade. And thankfully, I had teachers that encouraged me all the way through, and I was always going to go to the University of Arkansas. That was just what it was going to be. And I felt like that I got a really good education, and I was very successful after going there. And I was always trying to figure out ways of giving back to the school.
Kinslow began reconsidering his financial support of the university when he learned one of his scholarships would likely need to be modified to comply with federal and state law because it mentioned diversity. In October, Kinslow read about donated Ten Commandments posters being hung at the U of A to comply with a new state statute and says that was the last straw.
I've always been a very strong proponent of the separation of church and state, and I just felt like it was someone trying to impose their belief system on everyone else.
Kinslow has decided to pull both of his scholarships and cut the school out of his will due to the displays because he says they represent religious overreach into public institutions, which should serve everyone.
I'm very proud to have gone to the University of Arkansas, but I'm really saddened that this is happening.
Act 573 of 2025 requires a historical representation of the Ten Commandments be prominently displayed in public school classrooms and libraries, public institutions of higher education, and other public buildings maintained by taxpayer funds. Displays must be donated or purchased with funds through voluntary contributions. Posters that don't meet specifications required by the law may be replaced with public funds or private donations. A federal judge has blocked implementation of the law at a handful of Arkansas public school districts in a lawsuit focused on K-12 schools, but a suit challenging implementation of the statute at the higher ed level has not been filed. According to U of A spokesperson John Thomas, several dozen posters have been hung in multiple buildings, and installation is expected to continue throughout the fall semester. The displays are considered state property, so tampering or removal will be investigated and responsible parties could face criminal charges. Thomas says officials understand and respect that some students and employees disagree with the required postings, but it's the university's practice to comply with the law. Supporters of Act 573 have argued the Ten Commandments are a historical document because they influenced the nation's founders and their creation of the country's legal system. Opponents like U of A junior Nathan Gray argue the posters are unconstitutional.
What it really comes down to is it's purely religious. And I think that if they really felt that it was a historical document, that we would have something like the Bill of Rights placed up or even the Constitution, copies of that. A lot of their argument is that this is a document that's influenced the documents like the Bill of Rights. So I think we could just skip right to our rights, and how about we place those up in every classroom so every student knows their rights.
After seeing posters around campus, Gray hung his own flyers gauging interest in a teach-in, an informal lecture where participants can debate the constitutionality of the new law. He's received feedback from more than two dozen students and intends to host the event before Thanksgiving break. In-person discussions can be fruitful for developing solutions to issues, according to Gray, who says it's easy for his peers to focus on virtual actions like signing an online petition.
And those are really important, but I think getting together in person is a really powerful way of sending a message that we can organize together and that we do. The power really is with the students here and the people. And that's our main way of being able to show it, is just organizing together in a big room.
Gray says he hopes creating dialogue around this issue will encourage voters to consider their options for the 2026 election.
To make sure that we're all voting for people who really want to prioritize our constitutional values. And I think that right now people just aren't aware of a lot of this stuff, especially students.
For the Arkansas Advocate, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
A statewide advocacy group is facing unprecedented funding challenges in the midst of the ongoing government shutdown. KUAF's Matthew Moore has the story.
Disability Rights Arkansas released a statement last week that without new federal funding, they will be forced to make difficult decisions to preserve their ability to serve existing clients. Tom Massow is the executive director of DRA. He says as of October 21st, they have stopped accepting new clients.
Additionally, two more federally funded programs that we receive will also be running out of money probably the first or second week of November. And that would leave us with five smaller grants to draw from for the remainder of the year. So essentially, since October 1st, we have been operating on previous year's dollars, which we can do, while we wait for Congress to pass a budget for fiscal year 26. And that has had a considerable impact on staffing. I've had to furlough six staff as effective at the end of this month. In addition to stopping cases, we are also looking at, you know, what we need to do to wrap up cases, because I fully expect that come mid-November, you know, around Thanksgiving time, we will be having another tough conversation about where do we go from here.
When you talk about cases, can you give some details about what sort of work specifically happens within those cases that you're able to accomplish and take care of through federal funding?
Absolutely. So just for the at the beginning of September through the middle of October, we had about 310 people call and asking for information and referral. That's all types of questions that may come in. They may need assistance, you know, with transition from school to work, employment, working through the Medicaid system, or, you know, abuse, neglect in their community. So we have priorities, and when we deem it a case, it gets assigned to an attorney or an advocate for them to work it up and work with the individual to get the services and supports that they may need to, whether it be retain their job, get the job, or go to school, or, you know, get the services they need in the community to remain in their home.
During the legislative session this year, your organization was brought up, and a bill was passed to provide more oversight in the work that you do. Has that played a role at all in maybe having more advocates or more lobbying voices behind on the state level of people wanting to advocate for your work and for the government shutdown to help relieve some of this?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because when we were going through that, you know, we received no federal fund or no state funding. So we're completely independent from the state. So when that bill was introduced, when it came about, you know, we were specifically targeted as the only nonprofit in the entire state subject to this. And so that really took a toll on us. And, you know, the other nonprofits, there's only one nonprofit who actually spoke out against that bill. And everybody else hid because the retaliatory nature. And to be perfectly blunt, you know, they didn't want to stick their neck out there because they would be next. And so that has taken its toll. And the number of, you know, I've heard from a lot of individuals who support the work that we do, who are very upset that, you know, we are having to stop taking cases, even, you know, now and then when we had that incident back in April. You know, they're very upset and just trying to figure out what do we do. But in terms of the public outcry right now, it's pretty low key.
Are you worried that if this goes on for another 2-3 weeks that you'll just have to completely shut down DRA?
Absolutely. I think one of the other pieces that makes it more difficult for us as a federally funded nonprofit is once they reach a deal and the lights come back on, if they pass a continuing resolution or a full budget, it is going to take 4 to 6 weeks for the federal agencies to begin releasing the funding. What complicates that is due to the administration's, you know, reduction in force, a lot of the programs that the agencies that, you know, our program officers, fiscal officers have been terminated. So that's only going to further complicate the process to send the money to the states or to the agencies. So I fully expect us, you know, not to receive anything, probably not until the first of the year. And we will have to, you know, if that happens, there may be one or two people here, and that would be it, doing the bare minimum that we can do to keep the lights on, so we don't have to restart from scratch. And again, the impact and toll it takes on the staff, but also across the state, is huge. This is disappointing.
I'm sure that you have reached out to the federal delegation here in Arkansas, but here in a public platform, if you could, what would you want to say to our elected officials here in the state of Arkansas?
Yeah, so I have reached out to all of the congressional offices, and I've heard back from three of them. You know, Congressman Womack thanked me for the update, which I thought was really great. Senator Bozeman's office is going to look at, you know, expediting our funds once they come back. Representative Crawford's office is very disappointed to hear the news. I would just, you know, I don't expect our plea and our situation here in, you know, and Disability Rights Arkansas to completely shift bring everybody to the table to talk about, you know, reopening the government. I don't expect that. What I hope it gets accomplished is that when the deal is reached, that our congressional members will reach out to the federal agencies and push for funding to be released quickly so advocacy services can resume here in Arkansas, not only for us, but also there's other programs across the state who are going to be reliant upon the congressional offices to speak with federal agencies to release the funding. So my plea would be that once the government opens is to reach out to the federal agencies and start pushing them to release the funding quickly.
What gives you encouragement? What gives you hope that, you know, that obviously your work is needed and important, but how do you find gratitude and hope in this period?
You know, I think one of the, it's just going back to why we exist in the first place. You know, why does Disability Rights Arkansas do what we do? And that is to support individuals with disabilities. And so my fight, if you will, or my, what really gets me going is knowing that people need help and, you know, people need the supports. There's a lot of forces against them. And without us or an agency like ours, they don't get any supports. And so for me, just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And plus, we see the little wins. You know, we get calls or we see people who, you know, thank us for helping their loved one go to school or get the services they need, or supporting them in speaking out and having a meeting with their state senator, state representative. But as long as, you know, what has kept me focused is adhering to our mission, vision, and values. As long as whatever we do points to our mission and people don't like that, I'm sorry. People with disabilities deserve and should have a place in the community with everybody else. So we're going to keep pushing for that.
That was Tom Massow, Executive Director of Disability Rights Arkansas, speaking with KUAF's Matthew Moore. A new digital exhibition is now open at the Old Statehouse Museum in Little Rock. Reporting for Arkansas, the documentary films of Jack Hill will be on display well into next year. KASU's Marty Scarborough spoke with the museum's executive director, Daniel Cockrell, to learn more.
Jack Hill was a documentary filmmaker, but more than that, he was an outstanding person. the people that I've talked to, his wife, Ann, Dale Carpenter was one of his photographers for many years that helped him film these documentary films. And Jack, he went around and he wanted to tell the story of Arkansas. And he was an investigative journalist. And he would, if there was railroad crossing problems in the 70s and 80s in rural Arkansas, he would go and talk about that on the news and get awareness, bring awareness to issues that need help. And through this, he's doing a larger work. He's reporting on the news, but it's causing people to go to action. So I'd like to put that out there. Like, I've enjoyed studying Jack Hill because he would go in and just, he had a good interviewing technique like yourself, and he would get people to talk and just talk about what it is. And you would have a greater understanding of the topic when he was done telling you about it or sharing the story through somebody else.
Yeah, Jack for years was a reporter with KAIT in Jonesboro, but then left the TV station to create his own production company, Making Documentary Films. And as you refer to, he was never afraid to shy away from topics that could be somewhat controversial, somewhat noteworthy. What are some of the topics that he covered in those documentary films that he made?
His documentary film, he made over 60 documentaries, long form. That's 60 films, guys. And so some of them, he did a lot of health, like public health care topics where just if there was a need in the community, he would come in and try to identify the need. And then try to help people. So topics, a lot of healthcare. He did some athletic things like outstanding folks that had come and gone, just really shining a spotlight on small stories in small communities that really uplift the people in that community because it does that. There's too many, really. He won a DuPont Award for the economy of water, I believe is the one. And that's a prestigious award. That is... in that same year, he was presented several other awards. He's been nominated for several Emmy Awards. He's received the Peabody in broadcasting. I mean, this guy's done stuff that people aspire to in his life. And Jack passed away in 2012, and we're happy to bring him back to the spotlight of the public to kind of look back and say how much great work this guy did. And what he's done for me as a historian and a teacher and a scholar is I'm allowed to go back and look at any of these films. They're available through the Pryor Center in the University of Arkansas. And you can see Jack talking to these people and see all these many projects and all these topics. I encourage people to do that if you're curious. So when you come down, we'll have an introduction video in the gallery, which is 15 minutes. And it's Jack's wife, Ann, and it's Bob Cochran, the scholar, leading scholar on Jack. And it's Dale Carpenter, his photographer. And these guys talking about the work they did and talking about Jack himself. And the more I listen to these interviews, the more I fall in love with Jack Hill, man, you know?
So beyond that introductory video, tell us about some of the other things that are available for people to view as part of this exhibition.
So I would like to start with, there was a book. So Dr. Bob Cochran is a professor at the University of Arkansas. And he's a friend of mine, and he came to me, and he and Dale Carpenter wrote a book about the films of Jack Hill because they wanted people to learn about this. But there were only enough room to include so many films to mention in that book. And so it kind of gnawed on Dr. Cochran for a while, and he called me and said, Daniel, I'd like to tell people about some of the films that didn't get put in the book. One of them is a film about a man who suffered from dyslexia, but the community didn't know about it down in the lumber industry parts of the Arkansas. And they talk about this guy. He's training. He's studying for tests. Everybody at the company's helping him, but he wasn't able to progress and get his GED. And then at one point, somebody lays a yellow piece of paper or a over a document, and the brother can read. And Jack does a whole piece on this guy. And it's a heartwarming story. You can imagine how this is one that didn't make the book. And so we're going to feature that one in the theater, as well as about five or six others that didn't make the book. I will tell you that my personal favorite that I chose, he covered the tiller races. And there was a rear time tiller races in Southern Arkansas for a bit. The tiller races are no longer around. And once you see the video, you'll know why. It looks very violent. But I'd never got the opportunity to see them, and Jack did a documentary about it. So thank you, Jack. And I put that one in the theater myself just to give people the experience of seeing the tiller races.
So you're talking about the theater there at the Old State House Museum. So does it just simply rotate through different films that people can come in and see?
So that's a good question. And normally that is where we have, it's a very large screen, and we've got about 36 seats. The seats in there came out of the historic Central Theater in downtown Hot Springs. There's seats from that 1920s, 30s area that we rescued and put in there. And it will have a number sequence, and you can dial up one of the past exhibits videos. And for this exhibit, and Dr. Cochran knew that, and he approached me. He said, Daniel, I got a perfect exhibit for your theater. So we're going to have this intro video rolling as you come in, but at any point you can hit a keypad and dial up one of the videos that we'll have, like the Tiller Races. You want to watch that one? You dial 02 and it pulls it up for you.
That sounds fascinating. So you mentioned this is in cooperation with the Pryor Center, which is, I assume, the archive for all of his films. Is that correct?
That is, there are, if you don't know the Pryor Center, I would encourage your listeners to look up the Pryor Center. They do real good work, just documenting oral histories and histories the way they were perceived in the people living them contemporary. They've got a great collection, and they are online there. The Jack Hill videos are available right now, even the ones we're putting in the theater and the ones in the book. You can watch them today if you were to go out there and look at them. There's an Encyclopedia of Arkansas article about Jack Hill that, again, for references, guys, this is where I would go to look up the things I'm telling you today because they list it for us. That's a good question, though. Those are available on the Pryor Center. There's a connection. Their website is extensive. They have a lot of research materials there, but you can find them there.
I know you've already had an opening reception for this exhibition, but do you have any other special events planned to run in concurrence with it throughout the months it's going to be there at the Old State House Museum?
Yes, sir. We don't have it on the books yet, but when Jack passed away in 2012, he was working on a large film about the U.S. Civil War in Arkansas. And he had done the writing, he had done the filming, and all was left to do was the editing. And they made a little bit through it. So after he passed and some time passed, Dale Carpenter and the other guys that have worked with him took it on themselves to go ahead and finish Jack's final piece. And so at one point I would like to show that film here with an audience to the general public and kind of an homage to Jack's last piece, because I don't know if it's been filmed or shown publicly yet. So, I mean, Jack was just an outstanding person doing the same thing that we as school teachers and broadcasters and media folks, we're just helping people understand their world, right? Mm-hmm. And I think Jack was a master of that. And that's what I would like for him to talk about, Jack Hill. And there's got to be one of these crazy topics like the Tiller Races that will stick in your head, right? So maybe there's a lot of opportunities for that car ride home conversation.
That was Daniel Cockrell, Executive Director of the Old State House Museum in Little Rock, speaking with KASU's Marty Scarborough. Reporting for Arkansas, the documentary films of Jack Hill will be on display through September of next year. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Brain, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.